Chapter 7 Clutty of MI9. Late in 1940, Dodo Barry received an extremely odd letter from her husband, Rupert, one of the first British officers sent to Colditz. The opening line read, "I'm so glad to hear you are going to buy a puppy. The first dog in each three litters you will find the best." Dodo was not buying a puppy, let alone three from different litters. At first, she assumed her husband must have gone mad in captivity. What was he on about? She didn't even like dogs. She did, however, like crosswords. And on closer examination, she grasped that Rupert was using a simple code. Read every third word. This was not a letter about dogs. Because, in addition to stool pigeons, real and imaginary, the castle was home to another, more commendable sort of spy, the type gathering secret information and sending it back to Britain. The prisoners might be locked away from the world, yet as captives inside enemy territory, they had access to some important, or at least interesting, intelligence. And with a steady stream of new arrivals, newly captured officers or men transferred from other camps, that stock of useful knowledge was growing steadily. Observations on German troop movements, defensive capabilities, bomb damage, the location of potential targets, civilian and prisoner morale, food supplies, and so on. In order to pass on this information, the prisoners needed a method of communicating with London without the Germans knowing. Letters in and out of the castle were carefully screened for secret messages and heavily censored. References to names and places were systematically erased. Letters home had to be written in pencil, on glossy paper forms, to prevent the use of secret ink. The only way to send secrets to London was by code. And if such a secret cipher could be agreed, then London could write back. Once she had spotted the code, it took Dodo just a few minutes to read Rupert Barry's message. "Get from War Office, American Passport, Visa, ex-Sweden." She rushed to London and explained to an official that her husband was planning to escape via Scandinavia and wanted a fake American passport with a visa for Sweden. He did not get one. But a few weeks later, Barry received two letters from Christine Silverman, a maiden aunt living in Leeds he had not heard from in years. Using the same third-word code, these indicated that two parcels would shortly be arriving in Colditz from the Prisoners' Welfare Fund, containing a set of handkerchiefs and a pack of sugared almonds in different colours. Following his aunt's instructions, Barry dissolved the yellow almonds in water and then added the handkerchief with a green border. There, before his eyes, like a developing photograph, emerged the details of the HK or 560 code, the cipher for communications to and from British prisoners. The code was both simple and hard to crack, see appendix, and it remained unbroken for the rest of the war. Some of the intelligence supplied by POWs was already out of date when it arrived, but the psychological value of this link between the War Office and the camps was immense. By means of coded letters, the prisoners could send information, make requests, and receive orders in ways the Germans strongly suspected but never rumbled. With a reliable method of communication, the distance between Colditz and London no longer seemed so great, the impotence of imprisonment less oppressive. The men might be prisoners, disarmed and detained, but they were still fighting the war. Back in London, the War Office had begun to view the POW population in a different light, not as non-combatants irrelevant to the wider war, but as potential military assets. Auntie Christine in Leeds was, in reality, part of a new branch of British intelligence dedicated to aiding POWs and servicemen shot down or lost in enemy territory. It operated under various cover names, including the Lisbon Book Fund, the Welsh Providence Society, the Licensed Victuallers Sports Association, the British Local Ladies Comfort Society, and the Jigsaw Puzzle Club. but its official name was MI9, the youngest addition to the military intelligence family that already included MI5 and MI6. Originally housed in a single room at the Metropole Hotel in London, this new top-secret unit expanded rapidly, and at the start of 1942, it recruited the only person in Britain with first-hand knowledge of escaping from Colditz. Airy Neave was initiated into the bizarre rituals of the secret world as soon as he arrived in Switzerland. At the British legation in Bern, he was told, MI9 have asked for you. It was the first time he had heard the name, and instructed to go to Geneva, where a man reading the Journal de Genève would be waiting at the station bookstall. Sure enough, a slender Englishman in a pinstripe suit introduced himself as Robert. This was Nicholas Elliot of MI6, an espionage veteran with a taste for the absurd who managed the escape routes out of Switzerland. Elliot took Neave to a hotel brothel for a party, and then handed over false papers identifying him as a Czech refugee. An odd choice of nationality, since Neave could not even pronounce the name on his identity card. Having crossed the border into France, he and another British escaper were met by an elderly man wearing workers' overalls and smoking a clay pipe. "Good morning, gentlemen," said the Frenchman. "I am Louis Simon, formerly of the Ritz Hotel, London." The ex-waiter introduced them to a young, sad-faced Frenchwoman who transferred them to a black marketeer in Marseille who handed them on to the Pat Line, an escape route across the Pyrenees run by Pat O'Leary, a doctor who, despite his name, was Belgian. From neutral Spain, Neave was bussed to Gibraltar with 24 other escaped soldiers of every Allied nation, where they boarded a troop ship bound for Britain. 2 weeks later, he was sitting down to lunch in Rule's restaurant in Covent Garden with a middle-aged man in tartan trousers. Colonel Norman Crockett, a former head of the London Stock Exchange and now chief of MI9, had a straightforward philosophy. By training military personnel to avoid capture and aiding escapes from the camps, MI9 would tie up enemy resources, boost the morale of prisoners and civilians alike, and bolster the war effort. Soldiers, sailors, and airmen must cultivate escape-mindedness and treat evading capture, or escaping if caught, as a patriotic obligation. Every prisoner freed from captivity was another man back in uniform. Crockett came straight to the point. Would Neave join his team at MI9? "You are one of the very few who has had such experience." Neave accepted without hesitation. "I have become used to the atmosphere of escape and would do anything to help the people over there." MI9 was one of the smallest and most secretive corners of British intelligence, and one of the oddest. It was run by Crockett, but its presiding genius was Christopher Clayton Hutton, the most prodigious inventor of escape equipment in history. War has a way of finding useful employment for people who, in peacetime, would be dismissed as cranks and misfits. Clutty was such a person. Balding, bespectacled, and violently allergic to military discipline, he did more to aid the war effort than most generals, while working from a large underground bunker in the middle of a field to avoid being disturbed. His fascination with escapology started in 1913 when, at the age of 19 and working in his uncle's Birmingham sawmill, he met Harry Houdini. Hutton bet the American illusionist he would not be able to escape from a sealed wooden packing case. Houdini won the wager, but only by secretly bribing the mill workers to secure the lid of the box with false nails. This was a eureka moment for the young Clutty. But it would take another 27 years, 2 world wars, and failed stints as a journalist, film publicist, and soldier before he discovered his life's calling, inventing escape and evasion devices for MI9, a task he undertook with quite staggering energy and ingenuity. Clutty started by creating escape kits for downed airmen, before graduating to the even trickier task of smuggling gadgets into POW camps to help prisoners escape, using every corner of his exceptionally fertile brain. Maps of enemy territory were his first priority, and Clutty made maps as they had never been made before. Maps printed on silk with permanent ink that could be folded into a tiny size and hidden inside a chess piece or boot heel. Maps on edible tissue paper made out of mulberry leaves, which did not rustle when a prisoner was searched, could be soaked without disintegrating, and screwed up into a ball and then flattened again without losing shape. Maps sewn into uniform linings, concealed in books, gramophone records, cigarette tins and playing cards. He invented a compass from a magnetized razor blade. When this was hung on a thread, the G in Gillette pointed north. He hid miniature compasses inside food, tins, bars of soap, collar studs, pencil stubs and buttons which unscrewed the wrong way, based on the impeccable theory that the logical German mind would never imagine something might unscrew clockwise. He worked out methods to conceal money inside board games, hide hacksaw blades in parcel twine, or a screwdriver in a cricket bat handle, and fit hairbrushes with hidden compartments to conceal money and other contraband. Food tins in parcels were pierced top and bottom by the Germans and the contents inspected before being handed over. Clutty invented a tin with a double skin, a thin compartment between the inner and outer layers to hide maps, money, and even diagrams of enemy aircraft, should an escaped pilot contrive to steal one. His inventions for downed airmen included shoes with false heels containing emergency supplies, such as food and benzedrine tablets, a type of amphetamine to fight off fatigue, and flying boots which turned into civilian shoes and a warm leather waistcoat when the leggings were detached. Some prisoners arrived at Colditz already secretly equipped with a massive kit to help them get out again. Disguise was essential, and so Clutty put his strange mind to thinking about costumes. POWs were entitled to receive new uniforms, so he designed a reversible uniform with a dark lining which, when turned inside out, resembled an ordinary civilian jacket. After consulting the Wool Association to find the right material, he drew cutting marks with invisible ink on what appeared to be ordinary blankets. On receipt, a tailor in the prison community would develop the ink, cut out the shapes, and sew a replica uniform of the Wehrmacht or Luftwaffe. With the application of dyes, sent separately, these were virtually indistinguishable from the real things. Crockett allowed Clutty freedom to experiment, which was just as well, since the inventor was quite incapable of doing what he was told. "This officer is eccentric," said Crockett with pride. "He cannot be expected to comply with ordinary service discipline." This frequently got him into trouble. A blowpipe for French resistance fighters to shoot poisoned gramophone needles into the faces of SS officers was rejected as highly unsporting. He was arrested on Ilkley Moor while testing a miniature radio hidden in a cigarette packet. His driving was so erratic that he was given a driver who was warned, before taking the job, that her passenger was mad. The actor Desmond Llewellyn was a prisoner in the officers' camp at Laufen, and doubtless handled some of these extraordinary escape gizmos. Llewellyn would go on to play Q, MI6's irascible inventor, in 17 James Bond films, a fictionalised version of Clutty himself. Red Cross parcels were never used to smuggle escape equipment, since this would have violated the neutrality of the system and potentially imperiled the source of rations so vital to prisoner welfare. Instead, MI9 inserted escape aids into packets sent by family members, or under cover of various bogus charitable organisations at fake addresses. These parcels were known as phony, explosive, or naughty. The Germans even permitted signed receipts to be sent back for such packages, enabling MI9 to gauge which illicit equipment was getting through. Coded letters were used to alert inmates to what was arriving, when, and how. Although the system was imperfect, after discovering a map concealed inside a gramophone record, the British destroyed most of their music collection before learning that records containing contraband had a dot in a specific place on the label. Clutty tirelessly bullied British firms into helping him. John Waddington of Leeds allowed real cash to be included with the monopoly money in sets sent to prisoners. Wills, the tobacco company of Bristol, agreed to produce customised tins to conceal escape kits. John Bartholomew and Sons, the Edinburgh map makers, mass-produced microscopic charts on a variety of surfaces. MI9's productivity was prodigious. Blunt Brothers, a small instrument factory on the Old Kent Road in London, was at one point churning out 5,000 mini-compasses a week. Of the 35,000 Allied troops who made their way to safety from captivity or after being shot down, about half were carrying one of Hutton's maps. Christopher Clayton Hutton's bizarre achievements prove that war is not solely a matter of bombs, bullets, and battlefield bravery. They also serve who work out how to hide a compass inside a walnut. The most important map of all came not from a British mapmaker, but a German one. The Escape Committee surmised that over the centuries of its construction, the builders of Colditz must surely have drawn up a plan of the castle, room by room, floor by floor. A coded letter was sent to London requesting that a search be made for such a record, since it might reveal old drainage systems and possible bricked-up cavities in the massive walls. MI9 scoured the nation's libraries and eventually located in the bowels of the British Museum Cornelius Gurlitt's 19th-century description of the castle, including a detailed floor plan based on a 1696 inventory drawn up during the reign of Augustus the Strong. This showed every 17th-century room, staircase, window, cupboard and cubbyhole, many of which had since been walled over. The map was copied and dispatched to Colditz, concealed in a parcel that was not merely naughty, but priceless. Parcels from Britain occasionally included unexpected luxuries. Pat Reed was delighted to receive two boxes of Upman Havana cigars from some university friends. Each of the 50 cigars was kept fresh in an aluminium tube with a screw top. The tube made the perfect arse creeper. Much more durable than the cardboard toothbrush cases used hitherto, and sufficiently roomy to accommodate, in Reed's words, a button compass, 100 Reichsmarks in various denominations, a route map from Colditz to Singen, a workman's pass, and a leave permit on foolscap paper. There was poetic justice in the choice of brand. Herman and Albert Upman had used H. Upman Cigars Limited as a cover for running a German intelligence network in Cuba during the last war. But the real clue lay in the name, since Up Man was precisely their intended destination. This was the kind of joke Clutty liked. It is impossible to quantify how much contraband was successfully smuggled into Colditz and how many escapes were fostered by Clutty's inventiveness. But during the early part of the war, money, maps and gadgets flowed into the prison almost undetected. Before being handed over to the addressees at the parcels office on the ground floor of the inner courtyard, packages sent from abroad were inspected, but not rigorously. In the army-run camps, newly arriving prisoners were seldom properly searched. But early in 1942, the indefatigable Eggers smelled a large and pungent rat. Given the worldwide shortage of paper, some of the hardcovers on books sent to the prisoners seemed oddly thick. Those arriving from the Prisoners' Leisure Hour Fund in Lisbon were particularly fat. Slicing open the boards, the Germans found 100 mark notes, maps of the Swiss, Dutch, Belgian and Yugoslav borders, and even, in the case of one particularly hefty tome, a hacksaw. "We were a little late before we discovered what was going on under our very noses," wrote Eggers, who rapidly made up for lost time. Hardback books were banned. Food packets were opened before being handed over, and the contents of tins emptied into bowls so the interiors could be probed. Incoming objects were minutely examined, leading to some surprising discoveries. A German 20-mark note inside a prune, marvelled Unteroffizier Schädlich. Every arriving prisoner was strip-searched, his clothing and possessions pulled apart. One new prisoner brought with him a chess set, which Eggers found to contain 1,000 Reichsmarks, 3 compasses and 7 maps. Every parcel that did not emanate from the Red Cross was now thoroughly searched before being handed over. Finally, an X-ray machine from Leipzig was installed in the parcel's office. We subjected every incoming object without exception to its penetrating gaze, wrote Eggers, and it yielded swift results. A set of badminton rackets with hollow handles containing saw blades, maps and money. Clutty's methods of concealment grew ever more ingenious. That second winter in Colditz was cold, with temperatures dropping to minus 30. At the end of January, a coal shortage cut off the hot water supply for a fortnight. Freezing and filthy, the prisoners found their moods oscillated, sometimes abruptly, between defiance and resignation. The elation following the successful British escape was swiftly eclipsed by the discovery of the French tunnel. The whole camp felt the loss and were inwardly seething. The anger was compounded when Commandant Schmidt announced that the cost of repairs to the chapel floor would be docked from officers' wages. Hauptmann Priem, increasingly drunken and erratic, was helped upstairs to the meaningless role of deputy commandant. Eggers took his place as senior duty officer. It fell to me now to bear the maximum brunt of contact with the bad boys, he wrote. Whenever Eggers entered the inner courtyard, he was met with howls and catcalls, or worse. For a representative of the master race, Eggers was exceedingly thin-skinned. I was naturally upset to have aroused so much hatred, but as this arose from my job, I took it as a measure of my success. Eggers had microphones installed at 30-foot intervals around the prisoners' quarters. The ferrets were issued rubber-soled shoes in order to creep silently around the buildings at night. Use of the chapel was suspended. The park walk was restricted. At the end of January, Guy German was moved to another camp on the grounds that he was totally committed to promoting the escape of officers and also to collusion with disruptive and non-cooperative practices amongst the POWs. German was replaced as senior officer by Colonel David Stainer, a more diplomatic figure, grey-haired and grave. In the eyes of the prisoners, the tightened security measures were really petty punishments, humiliating regulations imposed out of spite, of which none was more irksome than the saluting rule. Under the terms of the Geneva Convention, prisoners were obliged to salute senior German officers. The Bavarian camp doctor was particularly insistent on this formality, and the solitary cells were crammed with prisoners who had declined to salute him, or had done so in an impudent way. One evening in late January, at evening roll call, a 22-year-old Belgian officer, Lieutenant Verkest, slouched past with his hands pointedly dug into his pockets. Eggers told him to salute. Verkest refused. At the resulting court-martial, the Belgian was found guilty of disobeying a direct order. But when it emerged during his testimony that Verkest had organised the Belgian contingent, now 33 strong, in a mass refusal to salute, the charge was increased to mutiny, carrying the death sentence. A casual act of insolence had escalated into a lethal confrontation. The entire company of prisoners united in outraged protest. When the doctor appeared in the courtyard soon afterwards, he was greeted with a chorus of jeers from the window, and insulting shouts of Tierarzt, horse doctor. The riot squad appeared with bayonets fixed and cleared the yard. The death sentence was later commuted by Hitler himself with a laconic note on Verkest's file. Sentence sufficient. But the so-called saluting war was a measure of how raw tempers were becoming on both sides. Upsurges of rebellion were sporadic, and, like escaping, at least partly seasonal. more acute in summer, less fierce in winter. At times, the escape planning and goon baiting evaporated, replaced by a sour acquiescence. The spectre of depression stalked Colditz, seldom openly discussed, but ever present. Morale ebbed and flowed, dependent on war news or an escape attempt, the latest theatrical entertainment, or merely a victory at stoolball. Spirits might rise with the arrival of a Red Cross parcel, or plunge again when the hot water stopped or an escape failed, as fickle and changeable as the weather. Prisoners with wives or girlfriends longed for contact but dreaded a Dear John letter breaking off the relationship. The POWs wondered and imagined what was happening at home. But unlike civilian prisoners, their sentences had no visible end, and no chalking off the passing days would bring liberation closer. Civilians, one prisoner reflected, could never imagine what it is like to get up in the morning to face a long, empty day with nothing whatever to do except what you do to yourself. Crammed into a warren of small rooms, the prisoners were seldom more than a few feet away from each other. The air felt musty, the conversation stale. Minor disagreements could flare quickly into angry confrontation. Tempers were short, and attention spans shorter. Some were undoubtedly experiencing what would today be diagnosed as post-traumatic stress disorder. A few of the afflicted spent hours in front of their cupboards, arranging and rearranging the few possessions inside. An obsessive activity Reed described as locker pottering. As time wore on, the symptoms of psychological damage grew more dramatic. It was a mental battle to keep sane, said Jimmy Yule, the jazz band leader. The prisoners were not alone in suffering under the psychological burden of Colditz life. The jailers of Colditz were also bored, cramped, homesick, and uncertain. On the 8th of February, the body of a young German soldier was discovered in the park. He had shot himself in the head with a revolver. No one ever discovered why. The captives, including the doctors and priests, tended to regard depression in much the same way that homesickness was treated in all-male boarding schools, a sign of weakness best ignored, since mollycoddling, it was believed, would only make the unhappiness worse. The stiff upper lip is a great thing to hide behind, one inmate remarked. Yet the POWs monitored each other carefully for signs of serious mental disturbance. Eggers was similarly alert. We didn't want them to go mad, he wrote. For all his pedantry and guile, Eggers was a humane man, and he had noticed that Frank Errol Flynn was starting to behave quite oddly. The RAF officer repeatedly tried, and failed, to escape. I wanted to get back to flying, he said simply. I had not had enough of the war. He had been sent to Colditz after escaping from Torn Camp and trying to steal a Heinkel bomber. Then he had been caught emerging from the toilet tunnel back in July. He contributed Frank's crowbar to the French tunnel, and that too had come to nothing. He had tried to hide inside a sack of outgoing packages in the parcels office, only to be caught before he was out of the room. On his way to solitary in the town cells, he had tried to break away from the guards yet again. On the 3rd of April, Eggers launched a raid on the British quarters that took everyone by surprise and found Flynn hard at work on a new tunnel. He was out of solitary on a 3-day break between 28-day sentences for his earlier escape attempts. A further sentence was added. This brought his total to 170 days, noted Reed, the longest tally of any prisoner so far. If you confine any animal, more and more it fights to get out, he said. Flynn was losing weight. Red Cross parcels were not permitted in solitary, and suffering from acute asthma. He developed his own survival strategies. Always make your bed in the morning. Think of the next thing you can do. Keep your brain alive. In an effort to keep fit, he did yoga exercises, a spiritual and physical discipline then almost unheard of in Britain. Not having been to public school, a sergeant pilot until he was commissioned as an officer in 1939, Flynn was always a figure apart. At first, he found enforced solitude a trial, then a matter of indifference, and finally, an unhealthy habit. "Solitary confinement did you a lot of good," he wrote. "It was a holiday in some respects from the continual noise, people escaping, guns going off occasionally. Seclusion," he decided, "offered trains of thought that you could work on. But the tracks led in unexpected directions. I was a Roman Catholic. In solitary, theology and things like that enter your mind. You can get a new look on religion. I changed my religion and had my own philosophy. I decided God is a self-regulating intelligence who works for the good of the whole. Every time he emerged from the cells, gaunt and intense, Flynn seemed a little more eccentric, a little more paranoid. He was convinced he had been betrayed." In the 5 months following Neave's home run, there were 22 attempted escapes by Colditz prisoners, some involving international cooperation. Only one was successful. A Belgian officer broke out after being transferred to a military hospital and eventually managed to swim to a British ship moored off Algeciras in Spain and stow away in the cargo hold. Every other attempt foundered. Two Dutchmen were picked up trying to walk out disguised as workmen. A French officer was found half suffocated in a cart carrying excavated tunnel rubble from the attics. An international tunnel under construction was discovered beneath a bed in the sick bay. A Dutchman was found hiding under a pile of leaves in the park. Poking around for gaps in the castle fabric, the Dutch located a hollow buttress adjoining their quarters, the shaft for an ancient long-drop toilet, once used by Elector Frederick the Wise, that ended 6 feet below ground level. A tunnel running horizontally from the bottom towards the ravine was just 15 yards from completion when Eggers raided it, hauling out two diggers and a huge stash of escape equipment. "The treasure was immense," he crowed, and included the two Dutch dummies, Max and Moritz, used to cover for escaped prisoners during parades. Eggers never revealed how he had learned of the tunnel's existence. Staring out at a blizzard one evening, Pat Reed noticed that 4 feet of fallen snow had piled up on the flat roof running between the second floor of the British quarters and a buttress on the wall of the commandantur. He cut through the bars on a window using a saw made from serrated razor blades, lowered himself onto the roof, and then burrowed a tunnel through the drift, shaped like an arch, 1 foot 9 inches high, wide enough to wiggle through unseen by the guard below. He had just completed gouging a hole through the wall into the German quarters when Unteroffizier Schädlich suddenly appeared, revolver drawn. Reed half jumped, half fell into the snow of the courtyard and scrambled away. Yet another escape had been stymied. The more philosophical prisoners put the run of failures down to bad luck. Eggers credited his own ingenuity. Others detected something more sinister. One evening, Colonel Bronislaw Kowalczewski, the senior Polish officer, ordered his compatriots to attend an emergency meeting in full uniform. The 48 Polish officers assembled in the Polish long room, including Ryszard Bednarski, a young army lieutenant. Bednarski, a forester by trade, was something of a celebrity among the Poles. In April 1941, he simulated illness and escaped while being transferred from Colditz to a military hospital. The officer who escaped with him was swiftly recaptured, but Bednarski managed to reach Krakow and remained at large for some weeks before being caught by the Gestapo. After many beatings, he was sent back to Colditz and a hero's welcome. The Polish adjutant called the men to attention. Colonel Kovalchevsky ordered the lieutenant to step forward. Second Lieutenant Bednarski, you are a spy and a traitor, unfit to wear the uniform and insignia of Poland. A brief court-martial commenced. Bednarski was accused of conspiring with the Germans. It was claimed he had been allowed to escape in order to infiltrate the Polish underground resistance in Krakow, before being brought back to the castle to continue betraying his fellow prisoners by revealing their escape plans. One Polish officer claimed that while in military hospital, he had seen a document proving Bednarski was in league with the Abwehr, German military intelligence. The verdict of this ad hoc tribunal was never in doubt. Some favoured summary punishment, arguing that Bednarski should be taken to the top floor of the Polish quarters and thrown out of a window, an execution disguised as suicide. Instead, with solemn fury, the adjutant ripped off Bednarski's epaulets and ordered him to leave the room. After a sleepless night of terror, expecting to be lynched at any moment, the trembling man was marched into the courtyard for the morning parade. 47 officers present, barked Colonel Kovalchevsky, and one traitor. Bednarski was removed by the guards and escorted from the prison the same day. The episode is mysterious. Eggers insisted that only one of the recently failed escapes had been foiled thanks to an informer. He confirmed that Bednarski had fallen into Gestapo hands in Poland, but claimed that far from betraying his comrades, the young man had returned with valuable information about the Polish underground escape networks, from which his fellow prisoners were able to benefit. His removal from Kolditz was not evidence of his collaboration, said Eggers, but to protect him from those who wrongly accused him. A few days after Bednarski was drummed out of the Polish army and almost murdered by his compatriots, the Germans took the unprecedented step of announcing during roll call that the man had disclosed no POW secrets to the German staff. In his diary, Schädlich recorded that Bednarski had merely sought to ingratiate himself with the Germans so that he can escape more easily. Frank Flynn was convinced Bednarski had revealed his escape plan to Eggers, but some in the Polish community voiced sympathy for a man who, if he had collaborated with the Germans, must have done so under duress. The Germans had some hold over his family, said Anthony Karpf, a Polish cadet officer in Kolditz. It is difficult to judge what a man does in that situation. Richard Bednarski may have been a ruthless traitor who betrayed countless fellow prisoners in Kolditz, but it is possible that he was entirely innocent. Some years after the war, a former Kolditz inmate recognized Bednarski on a street in Warsaw, publicly denounced him, and then informed the Polish authorities that this notorious war criminal was at large in the city. By the time police arrived at Bednarski's apartment, he had killed himself.